Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, June 7th, 2005. Today's session is entitled, Isaiah Removes His Shoes and Everything Else, Part 2 of the History of Biblical Shoe Removal, presented by Dan Erlander. Session number ERD-2005-02.
Good morning, and it's 9 o'clock, and we'll begin our second session I forgot what this whole thing is about. Standing on holy ground, taking off sandals, sandal taking off throughout the Bible. And today we'll focus on Isaiah 20. But first of all, I have several leftovers, etc., from yesterday. So here's just some leftovers. I mentioned Abraham and Sarah and the beauty of, I think, bringing Sarah in when we talk about the patriarchs. So we have our really father and mother of our family of faith. But then was reminded, poor Hagar always gets left out. And she was the one who was the most Christ-like because she was the servant, the slave, and was sent out into the wilderness with her child, and also is mother of our Muslim brothers and sisters, the Arab people. So I think we need to also remember her and give thanks for her when we think of our ancestors in the faith. So thank you, Hagar. Then the other was in sharing about theophanies, or those visions of God that we had. And then often these visions of God will make a holy place and a sacred place. And I closed last time with a personal theophany. And one thing that I think is important that I didn't tell about that incident on the grass in San Anselmo is that it wasn't really a theophany when I was there. It was later when I looked back on it, you know. So if any of you think I'm the kind that's walking around having visions all the time, and there's sometimes a little spiritual competition, you know, I had a better theophany than you did. So, but it was to look back and say that was a place where now I remember that in a strange way God spoke to me. And also to remember, someone mentioned about individual theophanies and how also communities have those times when they look back and say their God spoke or their God was. I remember one, this again is looking back, but I served this little church in San Diego, Spring Valley, that was always in financial disaster. Often had to wait another week before for the next Sunday's offering to get my check. And anybody familiar with situations like this? So one idea was, you know, to help our budget, we need more people. And so the next Sunday, a new doctor in town and his wife and three very beautiful children walked in to visit our church, and did we welcome them. We were so hospitable, and we were so nice to them, and they could see dollar signs in our eyes. And then, so they didn't come back next Sunday. In fact, they never came back. And we're back to our old budget. But then I remember from that, to look back, it was it was a message from God, the realization that we had not seen this doctor and his family as human beings with needs like all of ours, but rather we were seeing them for their money or how we could use them. And the result of this is that sometime later, every small town, and this was a small area outside of San Diego, every small town has that kind of town strange person that rides a three-wheeled bike and picks up cans and things. Do you know what maybe one of you is here. But, this was Bill. Bill, who rode a three-wheel bicycle and picked up cans, very slow of mind. And I saw him pumping up the hill to our church. I could see him through my office. And he came, I opened the door to welcome him. And he says, "I want to be a Lutheran. What do I have to do?" And so Bill was the only person in the new member class. And I had private tutoring for him for 4 weeks, and he didn't get anything. He didn't. So then we welcomed him as a new member. And I always remember that Sunday of it was Bill Day, you know, and a cake with Bill's name on it. And Bill dressed up that Sunday. He wore a necktie with one collar in and the other out, bedroom slippers. And he was just, welcomed with such warmth and stayed in that congregation. I think after we left, we heard he even married one of the members of the congregation, but it was a theophany because of that first experience. That we welcome people in Jesus' name. And but then again, we didn't see that. You look back and say, "Ah, that's a time, you know, when God was there and God was present." So lest you think I am, you know, I've never had the gift of sitting in holy little places and seeing visions and lights and some of you maybe have. And there's one scholar went around to Lutheran churches around the country to interview lay people about unusual spiritual experiences, and was amazed how many people do have. And he said, "One, more than I expected, had these kind of experiences. And two, most of them would never tell their pastor." It's always fascinating to me. Well, enough of that. One thing I wanted to mention is when we say a holy place, like God says to Moses, "Take off your sandals, for the place where you are standing is holy." It's just to reflect on what is a holy place. Especially from the Lutheran tradition where I'm from, part of Luther's teaching is that everything is holy. All creation is holy. There's no special part that is more holy than another part. And therefore, we don't have holy water, because how could you have holy water in this little bowl when all water is holy? Do you get it? Mm-hmm. You get it? So then, what do we mean by these special holy places, like Moses at the burning bush? And I thought about this, and what makes some holy places among all places that are holy? Does that make sense? What makes some is memory. Something happened here, and we go back to that place in order to remember. Now take the word remember and put a little dash after R-E. And what do you have? Remember. To bring back the experience and remember it or reconstitute it. And when I think about that, I think about the families that go to a little cross along the highway where one of their loved ones was killed in an accident. This is a holy place. It's a place to remember. Or to go to the baptism font or pool where we were baptized again, or to kneel in a chapel of some saint that has touched our lives. I want someday to go to the bridge in Selma, Alabama, and just stand on that bridge and remember. Or the tomb of Martin Luther King, to go to that hallowed place. And then to think about the sacrament that Jesus said, "Do this to remember me." When I was in confirmation, my dad was a teacher, and he was good at charts, you know, drawing little charts. Maybe that's where I got it from. But I remember always one was Catholic, Lutheran, Reformed. Does anybody remember this? Catholic turns into the body and blood of Christ. Reformed, it is remembering the body and blood of Christ. And then Lutheran in the middle was in, under, and through, which I'm sure we all understand. And it was always, this one was the best one. And part of the ecumenical conversation through the years is the realization that with the Reformed, we're really talking about the same thing, because if the sacrament is remembering, it is remembering a reconstitution of Christ and therefore the true presence of Christ. And it's for this reason I think we Lutherans have this relationship of sharing pastors and communion with Presbyterian, UCC, and Reformed churches. Well, that's all. That's all I have. Of called leftovers. Okay, moving around. Or is there any other response from yesterday before? I don't want to go past 10:15, or else I'll run out today. But anything left from yesterday?
Well, I'm glad that you said that you didn't realize that experience you had until later. Mm-hmm. Because as I thought about it, I couldn't ever remember having an experience at the time, mm-hmm. but only when I look back.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Were you ever at a testimony meeting, mm-hmm. where all these dramatic encounters with God?
No, I never have been.
Yeah, you haven't run in the I was going to say the right circles.
Careful.
But where all these dramatic testimonies of meeting God, and then imagine if you'd stand up and say, "Well, I was baptized and Jesus held me and has held me ever since."
I have relatives that were explaining to me what I should have had. And I was a failure.
And I hope you're hearing the no, no, no. You know, that God has worked in your life in ways that are different from others, and some do have Paul and the Damascus Road.
Thank goodness for those relatives, huh?
Anybody else? So, yeah, and I'm glad we did, because I went away saying, "Oh, you know, it's like just like what you were talking about." You know, hey, shall we?
What is the ingredient of a event like that? Is it just feeling the presence of God, or is it something else that that a person, you know, feels, for lack of a better word, feels? You know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would.
Well, I know that one time I was in a group it happened to be Curcio, mm-hmm. but we were in a circle, and it happened to be an Episcopal Curcio, and we were praying, and we were also, the priest would come, and then you were supposed to whisper what you feel about, you know, what you're praying about. And in that circle, I could have sworn that Jesus was right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't think we can define it.
Yeah.
I mean, it just, and it doesn't happen, it wouldn't happen when you say, well, today I'm going to have an experience.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other times that, even times you didn't think of at the time that you look back when God was very present. Yeah.
I'm such a slow learner. It sometimes takes years before I have my aha.
Before the aha comes.
Yes.
Yeah. Isn't grace wonderful? You know, you don't have to be a super Christian that has had multiple visions, but to just live each day by the grace of God.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And give thanks for those who have, and the ancient and the saints and all the, you know.
We're getting close to the theology of worship, aren't we? We're getting close to talking about what that is for Lutherans versus... Well, I'm blurting in. I mean, so many churches are designed on the idea to help people have a theophany every Sabbath.
Yeah.
And ours is, in my mind, Lutheran theology is designed to help people remember what God has done, this salvation history,
yeah,
which is, exactly. You know, yours is specific and mm-hmm. you shared with us, but,
mm-hmm.
but is designed on the history of God's actions versus, you know, we pray God will do something good for you today, and even that you will pray that God's kingdom culture will come to you now.
Mm-hmm.
It's such a different approach. I mean, I don't know. You know that, Ben.
Well, yeah, and also it's the difference between these personal experiences and then also the community. And sometimes communities have a day when, wow, something happens that we weren't expecting. Reminds me of a person who once said, you know, church is like baseball. It's really boring, but you never know when something might happen. So, do you want to say one more thing? I wanted to put this up. When we're talking about experience, our Orthodox brothers and sisters, Greek Orthodox, Russian Orthodox, an icon. Icon has never been considered just a piece of art hanging on the wall, but it is a window into the spiritual realm. And to stand before that icon is to see through the window into God's world. So it's like every time you stand before an icon in an Orthodox church, it's another theophany. And so because of that, I'm going to set this up today, by the candle. And I remember we were in Russia, or it was the Soviet Union at that time, about the same time Ronald Reagan was there. In fact, we saw his limousine. But we were on Saturday night at a Russian Orthodox church, and the one detail I remember is a mother holding a baby that was just standing before an icon, and neither was moving, but just looking. And I really felt that she understood what was happening, that she was looking through the window into another world. So, okay, let's move to Isaiah 20. And this is when Isaiah takes off his sandals and everything else. I'm wondering, is someone here from the drama group? They might have another agenda. They're all well. They're
you
all.
Can ask them to demonstrate.
I was just going to ask one of them to read.
John Paul is here.
Oh, John Paul, are you here?
Yeah.
Would you read the whole chapter of Isaiah 20? It's one of the shortest chapters in the Bible. And stand up. Or you are on holy ground.
In the year that the commander-in-chief, who was sent by King Sargon of Assyria, came to Ashdod and fought against it and took it. At that time, the Lord had spoken to Isaiah, son of Amoz, saying, "Go and loose the sackcloth from your loins and take your sandals off your feet." And he had done so, walking naked and barefoot. Then the Lord said, "Just as my servant Isaiah has walked naked and barefoot for 3 years as a sign and a portent against Egypt and Ethiopia, so shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians as captives and the Ethiopians as exiles, both the young and the old, naked and barefoot, with buttocks uncovered, to the shame of Egypt. And they shall be dismayed and confounded because of Ethiopia, their hope, and of Egypt, their boast. In that day, the inhabitants of this coastland will say, 'See, this is what has happened to those in whom we hoped, and to whom we fled for help and deliverance from the king of Assyria. And we, how shall we escape?'"
Has anyone read this before? Or anybody memorize this as your favorite? The Bible? Okay.
It's the first documented mooning.
Did you hear that?
Yeah.
The first documented mooning. Well, so here is one of the few other places in the Bible where there is the taking off of sandals and also all of the clothes. And Isaiah, haven't you usually thought of him as a rather dignified prophet? Because he was in the king's court and he had the ear of the king. And here he is, nude for 3 years, walking, and his nudity then becomes a proclamation. Well, shall we unravel this? And this is one of the prophetic or the tradition of the prophets is you not only speak, but you demonstrate. And today we would call it, I think, like street theater or a guerrilla theater, it's been called, where you put on a demonstration on the streets and with a prophetic word that's kind of under it going, Now, what was Isaiah preaching by walking nude for 3 years? Part of some of the background of this was it wasn't as shameful to Jewish people to be nude as it was to look at someone who was nude. Well, the example was Noah, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then when Jesus in the Sermon on the Mount said, if somebody asks for your cloak or your coat, give that person your cloak also. We've kind of sanitized these stories or these Beatitudes of Jesus and have forgotten that Jesus was really talking prophetically about nonviolent resistance in the midst of a society where the very rich were exploiting the poor. And a coat or a cloak was given as collateral for a loan. Is that? And then you got to keep your inner garments so you wouldn't be naked. But then the creditor had to give the outer garment back to the debtor at night and then would collect it again in the morning. Mm-hmm. Why?
For warmth.
Yeah, it was also your blanket at night. So that was a grace part of this setup. But now Jesus says on the Sermon on the Mount, if one of the very, very rich who is exploiting the poor has run you into deep debt, and now in public you have to give him your coat, just take off your cloak too, then what would you look like?
Naked.
Yeah, naked. And again, the greater shame is those who look, and you force them all to look. And then what is preached there by that action is the utter sinfulness and stupidity of this system of driving the poor into debt. Mm-hmm. You ever heard that before? Mm-hmm. Well, this, maybe some have, but it's... but again, it plays on this. So therefore, now Isaiah walking through the streets in the nude is a tremendous indictment against the people that look at him. Are we looking back at strange times with strange ways of doing things? But now I'll...
I don't know why this came to mind, but I was thinking of when we have someone on death row, and they only have a few people as witnesses to see lethal injection, for instance. Mm-hmm. But if that was public, wouldn't that disgust the public and say maybe we shouldn't have that?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a similar case?
Yeah, I hadn't thought about that, but either hiding reality, you know, where the, or similar is not allowing us to see any of the caskets coming back from Iraq. It's hiding of a reality. And the prophet then, in any way, visual or verbal, will expose the truth. About it. So now let's look at the historical context now of this and this is quite an entanglement, so I'll do my best. So we're talking about the last years of the 8th century BC. That would be the 700s. And the Assyrian commander-in-chief in Assyria now was the greatest power in this part of the world. And when you think of Assyria, we're talking about northern Iraq. Am I right? Yeah, northern Iraq today. And Sargon, the commander-in-chief, is putting down a revolt in Ashdod, which today is the Gaza Strip, or it was the Philistia of that time. And they were revolting against the Assyrian domination. And the revolt was either instigated or encouraged by Egypt. And this is what a small country would do if they chose to revolt against the greatest power is to align themselves with another large power that is against the greatest power to balance the power and maybe therefore make their revolt successful. You got it so far? Okay. Now, the 3 years that Isaiah walked around naked possibly corresponds to the 3 years of this Philistine revolt against Assyria. And the prophetic word is, walking around nude is to announce this is the future of Egypt and Ethiopia. And it was Egypt and Ethiopia that Judah was aligning itself with. In other words, turning to them for help against the Assyrians. And now what the demonstration of nudity is why would you ever align yourself with these two powers that are about to be crushed, and being nude was a sign of going into captivity. And the prophet is saying over and over by walking on the streets every day is, why would you ever align yourselves with these two countries that are revolting against the Assyrians, and you're revolting, depending on them for your safety and your protection? Why would you ever do that? The trust in Egypt and Ethiopia, and I, reading about this, I got a little confused about Ethiopia and Egypt, and I just started getting into this, and I think this time Egypt had an Ethiopian, regime, but I could be wrong. Sargon, the Assyrian commander-in-chief, sent troops, put down the rebellion in 711 BC, and I'll back up a little here. The symbolic action of remove your clothes and sandals, walk naked and barefoot for 3 years during the revolt. Assyria will lead away the Egyptians as captives and the Ethiopians as exiles. The young and the old will be naked and barefoot, and their buttocks will be uncovered to the shame of Egypt. They, Ashdod, shall be dismayed and confounded because of Ethiopia, their hope, and Egypt, their boast. And then in 20 verse 6 is a lament for the fall of Egypt and Ethiopia, on which Judah, the southern kingdom, had turned to seek help. Now, where we need to go here now is, what idea did the prophets have for the mission and for the life of Israel, or now it's Judah? What was the vision of the prophets for this covenant people of God? And one way to say it is that it's twofold. And one you would get in Isaiah 2, and the other would be in Isaiah 5. First, in Isaiah 2 is this vision and this dream of the people following the covenant. And by following the covenant, there'll be a society where all are equal under God. No one is exploited. The wealth is shared. People care about each other. It is a land of righteousness where everything is working together and therefore different than the other nations that are a hierarchy where the top people have most of the resources, the bottom people are slaves, and it's an enforced system. And then the dream of Isaiah in Isaiah 2, that nations will stream to Zion. Nations will come to Zion not to invade. They will come and say, wow, we've seen the way you live together. We've seen the righteousness. We've seen the joy of living together as a people under your covenant. Will you be our teachers? Will you be our teachers? So maybe we can learn to live this way. And that's where we get plowshares. The swords will be turned into plowshares. The nations will no longer learn war anymore because they have turned to Jerusalem to go to class and to learn that there's a much better way of living than the way of constant struggle, class struggle, war, invading, on and on and on. Okay, so that would be the first vision and dream of the prophet, that the people become a covenant people. And now the second one is Isaiah 5, and it's similar, really. Isaiah 5 is that the nation will practice justice, and that is the Hebrew word mishpat, which is a different meaning than the typical American meaning of justice, which tends to be criminals getting their due. But justice means a people living together in harmony under the covenant, with the covenant, worshiping God, and therefore the widows, the orphans, the sojourners are cared for, and no one is hungry, no one is left out. Everyone has dignity because this society lives by justice. Now that I said there are two, there are really only one. I just realized I said the same thing for both. But what the prophets understood from the covenant that came from Moses, that the mission of this nation is to be so different than the other nations that the other nations will be attracted to this way. And then there will be world peace. What do you think of this idea?
Great.
And now, what Isaiah is angry enough about to take his clothes off for 3 years is that they're just trying to live like all the other nations. You know, finding this coalition here, this nation, balance of power, get our military connected with their military, and then we will have strength enough to take on the Assyrians, and on and on and on. And this is the opposite of what God meant in creating this people, to be a light to the nations. Some of the most wonderful writing that comes out of Israel and Jewish scholarship and Jewish some rabbis, of course a minority, is the writings that we read is the wall, the Palestinians driving them out of the land. This is not what God meant in creating this people. And these are some of the courageous voices among calling them back to the prophets. So, what do you think of this?
The reason for Isaiah taking off his clothes becomes clear. Why did he put his clothes back on?
He must have had another sermon. according to the scholar that I've worked that has helped me on this in the New Interpreter's Bible, Jane Tucker from Atlanta, Chandler, is that in Atlanta? Now that I remember that, I forgot what you asked.
Why did he put his clothes back on?
Oh, yeah. Why did he put his clothes back on? The prophets did these demonstrations, you know, for, as I mentioned to you. And supposedly, I'm just guessing, there would be a time when that message is over. And there would be a new, you know,
I wonder if somebody can help me. I wonder if he would feel that that message had failed, or if he hadn't been effective enough, or if God hadn't used him properly, or if he was shaking the dust off his sandals and going on to the next town, or
If it's true, if it's right, what Gene Tucker says, that it corresponded to the 3-year revolt. At the end of 3-year revolt, Ashdod was crushed, and now the Assyrians have gone against Egypt, and so it would be not that the prophet changes so much as history changes, and now there's a new situation. So that's as close as I can get, I guess.
What does this have to say to us? Because in essence, Isaiah was really speaking to a theocracy. And we're not.
Yeah, this would be a...
although there are people that would like us to be a theocracy. Mm-hmm. A Christian theocracy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'd like us to be my kind of Christian theocracy. But let's look at this. I mean, the danger is to say America is the new Israel, or the new chosen people, the light to the nations, the beacon on the hill and everything, and then to establish a Christian theocracy. And the idea of it is, if we would only get Christians in all the power positions, then everything will be right. Well, it would be very right.
Very right. It has to be the right kinds of Christians.
My question is dead serious. If we label the world in terms of axes of good and evil, mm-hmm. and we label ourselves as on the axis of good, what does Isaiah say to us?
What Isaiah would say? He'd probably take his sandals and clothes off and walk up the Washington Mall.
That's what I should do in my parish.
Yeah, that would be something for your sabbatical.
I would get arrested.
Isaiahs among us today?
Mm-hmm. Who are the Isaiahs?
Yeah. Who would be Isaiah speaking?
I don't know. Do you have an idea? Or,
not at all.
You know, could you hold that?
Yeah.
I was going to close with that, okay. So I'll...
I wasn't on time, was I?
You were supposed to... I told you to... at 5:02, okay. What I'd like to do before then get right back to that is just kind of finish what happened. And then, let's see, where... If anybody wants to have a theophany, I'm looking at that. Okay, here it is. This was 7-11 when this happened, the whole revolt, or that 3-year period there. Then Isaiah goes on to the preaching of to be a different kind of a nation, But as often the prophets, the people don't get it. It's only centuries later when we're sitting here reading Isaiah that our prayer is, they didn't get it. God, may we get it. But we have to talk about how from this. But 705, the king Hezekiah rebels against Assyria and seeks Egyptian help, like the normal way of operating as a small country. And they were encouraged by the Ethiopian dynasty in Egypt. The Assyrians swept in. They destroyed 46 cities in Judah. And then they put a siege around the city of Jerusalem. And nothing could be worse in ancient times than a siege around your city, knowing that they might starve you, cut off your water supply, and when they finally breach the walls, it's terror beyond, I think, our understanding of what happens to the people behind the wall. So every day they would stand on the walls and see the Assyrian encampment around Jerusalem, and they would see them as they were preparing for the attack and to breach the walls. And then one day they were looking over the walls, out over the hills, the camp of the Assyrians, and guess what they saw? They are all taking up their tents and folding them up, putting their tents onto their wagons. And after a few days, as they were doing this, they saw the entire Assyrian army moving on the road down and north with their entire army. What would you think?
Dodge that bullet.
What's that?
Dodge that bullet.
Yeah, lucky. But we know from history that the Assyrians had a much, much more important battle in another place. And the idea is we can come back to Jerusalem anytime and take this little place. So they did not want to use their equipment, people, soldiers. So they're off. How would the Jewish people see this?
God save them.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, now when we will move into the Babylonian era and the Babylonians are threatening to come, can you see how it would be? God saved us before. God will never let God's city with the temple be destroyed. So basically, Isaiah died probably, it's a guess that he was executed by Manasseh, a very, very, I don't know what word to use, evil king of Judah that did away with Yahweh worship and restored idol worship and fertility gods and goddesses to the temple in Jerusalem. So that, and then this this led then to eventual doing the same thing of trying to be normal against the Babylonians. And then when the Babylonians come, it is just an absolute and utter devastation and destruction of the temple and the walls and the whole city of Jerusalem in flames and the people being taken into exile into Babylon. So that that is the, now let's work a few minutes. But first I want to show these, to show that Isaiah, in taking his clothes off, that this was kind of a normal thing of prophets. They never just preached with words, but they were always doing things that would be symbolic demonstrations of the words they were teaching. And these, if you ever want to just look these up, these are some examples of of the signs of the prophets pointed to, or the dramas that they set up, and then how Jesus was in the line of the prophets. You know, didn't, by the way he ate dinners. This was preaching. Jesus' entry into Jerusalem was a very, very planned out prophetic event. And this Dr. Tucker then shows how this has happened in our time. And I'll just mention a few here. I'll just remember some. Was it James Meredith that enrolled at the University of Mississippi, was it?
Yes.
Yeah, and his going back every day, and then sitting in that classroom day after day exposed the whole system. And what happened, and this is what Tucker says that the prophets were about, that not only would their actions name the truth about society, but it would actually set off the spark that would lead to a change. And I think Martin Luther King understood this. Other prophets in our country have understood this. The remember during the Vietnam War, the Berrigan brothers breaking in and pouring blood on missiles. I mean, this wasn't some wild left-wing idea. This was biblical prophets today. And his idea was it not only exposes, but it actually has the possibility of creating the change from what the action is exposing. Which now goes back, we have a few minutes, goes back to this. Why don't I start by saying the worst thing that could ever happen would be, I think, for our nation to become a theocracy. That's just my big grand judgment.
But isn't that the danger of assuming something false about holy ground? That God is, I mean, that's the lesson in 587, 590, when suddenly the temple is no other, it's like any other building. It can be torn down. Mm-hmm. I mean, the theocracy in the United States, some people, I think, believe that somehow if you just put people of faith of a certain dimension in the right positions, that assures the blessing.
Mm-hmm. Like judges.
Yeah.
Doesn't every culture, or don't a lot of cultures, arrive at a point where they become sort of an extreme expression of what they've been all along as they've evolved? And as an extreme expression, the way they present themselves to the rest of the world and conduct themselves in the rest of the world becomes almost an embarrassment, an exposure of what, not just what they are, but what they've been. And I really wonder if that isn't what was happening with Isaiah, and what isn't happening with us right now. There's a nakedness there that's very hard.
Thanks.
And I try to be critical of the right wing, but I realize there are degrees. Yeah. And I have to also, first of all, recognize a participation in lesser degree in what's happened. There needs to be a repentance before I really can start pointing a finger.
I'm sure we'll get into more of this when we talk about globalization.
That's kind of where we were going.
And how the One prophetic demonstration that's happening now that I don't, people that do it are not aware that this, probably not aware that this is in the tradition of the prophets, but it's all the different ways of boots and signs and crosses were all over the United States. Pictures of all the soldiers and Marines and others have died are all put together. And I think it's really in the tradition of the prophets to name the reality of what's.
That's the theology of the cross, to call it for what it is.
Yeah, exactly.
Very, very prophetic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there's this tradition also that follows through if you go to the Holocaust Museum. I mean, that was a nation. Mm-hmm. The shoes and boots of all of the children and who were killed at that time. But I'm also thinking, when you were talking about a nation, the extreme part of it, and I'm sure it's easier to talk about someplace else, but when one thinks about South Africa, the previous South Africa, but how difficult it is to make a new nation of lots of voices that they're working with now.
Yeah. It is not easy.
But these are God-fearing people, the people who were going to make a Christian nation out of South Africa. Mm-hmm. All of them.
Yeah.
What is the extreme?
I have this might be your last.
How much is holy ground territorial? I think the whole idea of Israel, that's our holy ground.
Mm-hmm.
And that raises some interesting questions. I mean, can you identify holy ground outside of individual experience with territory that is only for your kind of holiness?
Yeah. No, a nation will have holy ground, and we have the Lincoln Memorial.
But times change. I mean, the whole thing in Isaiah and the prophets. Okay, you have the Assyrians, but what happens to the Assyrians? The Babylonians or the Chaldeans come in. Okay, who's next? Persia, or read modern Iran, for example. Mm-hmm. And Cyrus is the Lord's anointed to bring them back. But then what happens to Persia? Here's Alexander, the Macedonian. So empire after empire sweeps in there. Mm-hmm. And it also is a reminder that, we as a righteous empire now, who's next?
Mm-hmm. Which reminds me of Abraham Hillel's things that I read this somewhere, therefore it's true. But I read that somewhere. That when the Roman Empire fell among Christians, there were really two responses. One response was, all is lost. All is lost. And then the other response was, wow, maybe God has something new and wonderful. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking about the more that's being said about America as empire, not only by critics, but also by those who are in power, are saying that word more frequently, at least as I see it, is that what does it mean to be the church, like when the Roman Empire fell? Are we preparing each other for that time? So we will say, wow, what God must have to do next. Rather than all is lost. But, here's
sir. If we believe that there was a evangelical uprising in the last elections that we had in this country, is someone like James Dobson, a modern day Isaiah, he exposed his backside by proclaiming what his beliefs were. I think that's what we interpret now as exposing ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And they stepped out And according to the press, that swayed and won the last elections that we had for our representatives.
But the question is, and how do we discern what is a prophet or who is a prophet? And,
sure, just like they did. No one knew, maybe until centuries later.
Yeah. It's time. Close with this, and we'll again, like we did today, we'll have this go over into the next.
Yeah, but you can't possibly close with that. You got to lift up the ELCA chaplain who was let go over at the Air Force Academy for speaking against us just 2 weeks ago.
But not against America, but against Dobson.
Against the evangelization of the Air Force Academy.
Oh, yeah.
So she was let go of her position and moved to Alaska. No, excuse me, Japan. So there's again, you have to discern who is the Isaiah. I think prophets always speak for those who are not in power, whereas Dobson speaks for those who are in power.
And some are chaplains of the empire and some are prophets. So you have to discern which. I personally think Dobson is a chaplain of the empire.
Well, I think that is the at least that would be the test for me. Is a preacher or a prophet type, you know, on the side of those who are in power, or on the side of the poor, the widow, the orphan, the powerless, the vulnerable. I think from the whole biblical story, I don't know, what do you think of that?
I believe that there are, when we search, and just as in that time, this is one side. I believe there were prophets probably from both ways, which there always are. Mm-hmm. There's going to be someone that predicts correctly and someone that predicts incorrectly. And we tend to remember the prophets that were the winners. History tends to support that.
Well, I think
the ones that their prophets were true, those are the ones we tend to remember.
I think it's interesting that Dobson appeals to Scripture, and this this chaplain, his name is Morton, Melinda Morton, appealed to the Constitution. I think that's so fascinating. And I think in some sense, we drove here from Utah, and I thought there were so many religious signs everywhere. I don't know if you've looked at least in the West there are, maybe in the East there are religious signs, but Utah, Oregon, which I thought was sort of an atheistic state, but is not.
No, just the Portland metro area.
and Washington State are filled with religious signs everywhere. And it seems to me that maybe one of the ways that I happen to be an ELCA Lutheran, that we could be part of the community, is to know our own constitution and look at the separation of powers.
And I'm therefore, in a Lutheran sense, to be good citizens.
Exactly right.
Of our nation.
And to be clear about the distinction between kingdom on the left and kingdom on the right, mm-hmm. and that theocracy is not possible nor desirable.
And
excuse me for preaching.
No, I mean theocracy and the Lutheran understanding of church and state would be an oxymoron, is that? Well, I think
maybe you could at another time just talk about what a prophet is, what a prophet is.
Okay.
There was a very interesting reference to what you were just talking about, and I just happened to hear it a little bit on Sunday morning, very church of all things. Ira Glass in This American Life, it's a NPR program, actually did it's an hour-long program, and I only got a very little snippet of it, but it talked at both sides, and it looked at the constitutional issues, biblical issues. And it'd be fascinating to hear the full transcript of that, which I think you could pull up NPR's This American Life.
It's called This American Life?
Yeah.
That's on the internet.
Okay, well, next time I forgot if we're looking at, I think it's Amos next time? Or,
I think so.
Yeah, and then it's Amos, Ruth, and then the last one. So we'll continue this tomorrow. One disclosure, to think about the word normality and abnormality. Is that how you say it? Is this normalness? Is it normality?
Normalcy.
Okay, I know that's a confusing. Normalcy and abnormalcy. And to ask the prophet, is the prophet always one that brings the word of the abnormal? We'll pick it up tomorrow. Thanks. Keep your clothes on and be
Oh, come on.
Oh, honestly, somebody about their clothes don't.